We will begin on Exodus Lesson 1, and this covers chapters 1 through 3 of Exodus. So, what did you think of the story of 1 through 3? Tell me the story that we've gone through so far. Just 1 through 3. Don't go through 4. What's happened? What's happened in this story of Exodus?
Well, the first part is Joseph is taken by his brothers and thrown into the cistern and then sold, and he ends up in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a famine. And before that, God tells Jacob not to go into Egypt, to go where he says. And then there's a famine, which brings the brothers into Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
so we start the story of Exodus with the story of Joseph being already in Egypt and all the sons of Jacob coming into Egypt, right? And, of course, it starts out with the fact that they have all died now. That generation has died, and there's a new generation in Egypt. And what is happening to this new generation in Egypt?
Multiplying rapidly.
Then what?
They're being oppressed.
Oppressed.
Well, the Pharaoh dies, and
mm-hmm.
that is worried. The new Pharaoh has them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? So we have all of Jacob's sons and descendants being oppressed in Egypt. Then what comes next?
Pharaoh wants those midwives to, get rid of the boys.
Okay. So they're seeing the Israelites as a threat, and this new Pharaoh wants to get rid of them, so there's an edict to kill. And then?
The midwives do not obey the edict.
Mm-hmm.
And they're blessed.
Yep.
God, I don't understand. It says then Pharaoh said to his people to kill the first.
All the people. So now it's not just
anyone
the midwife's duty.
Now it's
all Egyptians have the duty to kill a young male.
Oh, a young Hebrew male.
Correct.
That's what I wasn't sure
correct.
About.
Yeah.
All Egyptian males.
No. All,
okay,
all
so
the Hebrew
any
males.
Any Egyptian can kill
a young newborn.
Male.
Yeah.
And was that considered a crying out? The midwives were like, no, I'm going to do my own thing. That was one of the crying outs that got heard.
Of the midwives hearing? Good question.
They probably cried out for their protection.
Sure, sure. It would definitely be during that time. Yep.
The Lord,
Yep.
So how many years was that was happening?
That the killings were happening? We don't know for sure. I could teach a whole class on just the actual history of that, who the Pharaoh was at the time, who, and he probably wasn't a natural Egyptian. He was probably actually a Semite, which makes everything really interesting. But we'll not go there today. after this, so we have then the boys are being killed, and then what?
Then
Moses is born, and then
and
what?
From the tribe of Levi in
mm-hmm. Yep, yep. So he's a beautiful baby. The word beautiful there is the word tov, and you all know that word in Hebrew, mazel tov. That's tov. It means beneficial, good. So it's not beauty of the face, it's good within, beneficial to others. So Moses is good, beneficial. What happened to Moses?
Hidden and found by Pharaoh's daughter.
Okay, so he's hidden and found by Pharaoh's daughter. Gets
okay.
A
have you ever, we can't totally put ourselves in Moses' mom's place, but I think of all, I was trying to read it through a mother's eye.
Mm-hmm.
And this poor woman, I mean, she has the baby. I can't even imagine all the heartbreaking things, putting it in the Nile, then the mm-hmm. rejoicing to get to nurse him, and then having to get him
mm-hmm.
back,
mm-hmm.
be thankful that he's alive.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh.
Did we ever study anybody, any other mother that did that?
Well, Hannah.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Hannah did the same thing, right? And where did she give her baby?
To the Lord.
What do you think Jochebed is doing?
She's
giving him to the Lord.
And they said to one of our readings said that she knew he was blessed. She
mm-hmm.
knew.
Mm-hmm.
She knew. Because I'm thinking, I couldn't put a baby in a basket down the river.
Yes,
she knew.
Okay, we will definitely get into that. Let's finish the story. Let's finish this story.
I have to tell you guys something about this baby thing. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this before, but you know, I have all my kids watch the Prince of Egypt movie because they're all adopted. And every time we get to the basket scene where the mom puts Moses in the basket and starts crying, because the first two have open adoptions, they always ask every time, "Did Anna cry? You know, did Anna cry? The birth of what she gave you?
Wow.
What she gave me to you?"
Wow.
You know, and last night, Robbie's birth parents are moving to Michigan. They're married, and they have another, so he has a full sister.
Oh my.
And we were talking about it again in front of them, because the kids were asking about it, and Robbie looked at his birth mother. Mm-hmm. And now, she didn't nurse him, but she comes back to see him, right?
Yeah.
And he said to her, "Did you cry?"
Oh. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And she said, "I did." And the birth father said, "And I cried too." Right?
Wow.
Because we love you.
Wow.
So,
wow.
You know,
yeah,
it's,
really.
It's similar to the girl
wow.
who does that, who says, "I love you so much, I'm going to."
Yes.
It's
yes,
a,
exactly.
It's the first selfless decision
yes.
a mother makes, you know.
Boy, that's a really good point, Eileen. That is really going to feed into what we're going to look at.
Yes.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect.
Yeah. So I just had to say that.
Yep.
Your party, you have to open. I mean, that's
got to
be hard.
You know what? It's not. It's easy because the kids want to know, and we've learned so much about open adoption. It's but to hear them ask,
wow,
oh,
wow,
you love me,
wow,
you know, it's like,
that's
oh
pretty
my
cool.
Gosh.
That's
well,
pretty
that's
cool.
What you were saying, the it's happening to every girl who does adoption.
Yep,
and she's crying.
That's
she
right.
Loves them, but
that's right.
For them, right.
Okay, so Moses gets adopted by Pharaoh's daughter and rises up as a prince. And then what happens?
He gets into a scuffle.
He gets into a scuffle.
He premeditates the murder.
He premeditates the murder, yeah.
He looks
yep.
right, and then
uh-huh.
he fell.
Good, yep.
But his fell, you know, was being, his ego was being
so
up.
He knew he was, I felt stupid when I was reading that. He knew he was a Hebrew?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. He had an open adoption.
Because he would have been circumcised, right?
No? Yeah, he would have been. Yes, he would have been. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay. So, what happens after the murder?
The next day. Yeah.
Then the Pharaoh is angry at Moses, and he runs away.
Okay.
So. All the other people are gonna murder him too.
Right.
Anyway, he's a murderer.
So Pharaoh.
He didn't really leave because he was scared of the Pharaoh.
He left because Pharaoh tried to kill him.
Yeah.
Pharaoh did try to kill him. Moses leaves and goes to Midian.
And then the next part, totally, if any of you have watched Jungle Book, the old Jungle Book, you know, the old one, and then they go, the pretty girls are going to the one, I'm going to fetch some water, by, you know, or whatever, and then you see the Jungle Boy, it's like, they're fetching water, and then they see
there's this
boy, it's totally from Jungle Book.
That's so funny. Very funny.
And he's really soft, sweet, beautiful girl. And he's rescuing them, and he helps them, and he cares for them. And he says, "What are you doing with this guy? Have him come back."
Okay. So he ends up marrying one of them. And how long does he stay out in the wilderness?
40 years.
40 years.
He's a shepherd.
He's a shepherd. Humble shepherd for 40 years. And then the burning bush. And we have the edict now. Now is the time to deliver. Okay, so that's the story that we're looking at. And those are the kinds of things we're going to see. So that's kind of where we're going. Yeah.
I've always wondered about this. In Exodus 3:5, when God said, "Do not come near here, remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you're standing is holy ground."
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I find it interesting. I mean, again, just from my little human mind, I'd feel, really in my mind, I'd be thinking, just my sandals, like, I think I need to, like, remove myself from this whole proximity, you are holy, I am so not. What's the significance with the sandals?
I'll talk about that when we get there.
Okay.
We will get there.
Okay.
I promise you. Okay. We will do our memory verse if we have time, otherwise next week we'll work on it well. Remember, the theme of Exodus is, I am, will take me out of bondage, right? To where? Okay. And man, don't forget that. He takes me out of bondage and he doesn't take me right to the land. He takes me to the wilderness. For what purpose?
To
To train me up in order that I might know him. And that is experience him in relationship. So that's the theme of Exodus. Most of you remember Betty. She was, for those of you who don't, let's see if I can get through this. She was a member of our class. She was one of my best friends, and she passed away in May. I had the privilege of being under her in her ministry. She was a director of theater. And that's what she went to school for, and that's what she did in the churches. I was involved in theater since I was actually in first grade, and I did a lot of theater. But it wasn't until I became friends with Betty and was able to take a lot of different roles and not just acting, but a lot of behind-the-scenes roles and sit with her when she was directing, sit with her when she was making decisions about directing, even basically when she was doing that for her job, that's all she was about, was everything was about the story that she was going to portray. And it was a story that was going to be portrayed so that other people could know the amazing and awesome God. And so her whole life was about that. And we would sometimes be doing things, having nothing to do with the play. And I remember one time specifically driving down Washington. Mm-hmm. And they were, do you remember when Pioneer Park down by over by Trader Joe's across the street? Mm-hmm. It used to have split rail fencing right there. Well, we were driving down there, and they were taking the split rail fencing down, and it was just sitting in piles. She said, stop, oh, pull over, what? Well, you can't pull over on Washington. Yeah. Look at those split rails. Those are perfect for the play. And I said, Betty, those are huge legs. No, I think we should get them. Well, wait, we can't just take them. Well, where do you think we can go to find out whether we can take them? So we spent the day going around the city of Naperville, and we went to the park district. They didn't know whether we could take, we went all over the place. Anyway, after I finally left her, I didn't get them. She found a way to be able to get them and took these rails. I remember walking one day in the neighborhood, and it happened to be Thursday morning, garbage day. And we're, just walking, and what did she see? Either, I think, huge cardboard, like appliance cardboard things. Stop, we got to take those home. We got to get home and get your car and come back. I mean, it was all about what was needed for the play. So she was always thinking that. And it isn't until you're kind of with someone like that to realize how much goes into telling a story like that. So it isn't just, so if you're an actor, you know when you have to be there, you know when you have to have your lines done. And for Betty, being in a play, and Karen can attest to this because she was also involved in this. Being an actor in the play did not mean you just went there for the two-hour practice. In fact, she didn't really have a time limit on her practices. They just went on. And I can remember being a stage manager at one time, being in behind the actual scenes, and one of the new actors going, I cannot believe this. What does she expect our whole life for this? And I thought, oh, yeah. If you don't believe that, you're not gonna survive in here, because her whole life was getting this story on. So sitting with her, understanding that all that she was doing was essential to getting that story told. And so although all the players had different choices to make, they were under her control, and she made sure that story got told. And everything she did actually was a decision so that that story would be told in the right way. There was a time when she and I butted heads, and I said, I think you're making a wrong decision here. I think that's just, it was a story about teenagers and what happens when they do go outside of marriage and have sex. And I mean, I'm going, Betty, you're going way too far. And she said, Jill, trust me on this. I've heard you. I'll think about it and I'll pray about it. But trust me on this. I do believe this is the right direction to go. Well, I really didn't. The play went on. My son was in it. And it was powerful. It was so powerful that it was one of the only, it was one of three plays that she actually took on the road and took places. It ended up being the right decision. So it was interesting how I'm thinking, the this is wrong, this is just wrong, it doesn't work. But yeah, it worked. It worked more than we could have imagined. So what I want us to see is that we look at what's out there. So if I'm an actor, I look, I have 2 hours to do this. You know, I have to learn my lines now, and, you know, I only have this amount of time. And those who were painting scenes, like Karen painted most of the scenes, you know, she had her focus on the scenes. But then to see it all put together, it was like, oh, there's more to the story than I knew. It wasn't just me. There was stuff going on in the background I didn't know. And all of a sudden, all these pieces come together. The fact is that we tend to look at the story only from our perspective, right? What's going on in our life? What's our story? And we don't realize that there are things going on behind the scenes that are working to put it all together to make a story of life. So I want us to think about the fact that what we see as the story is often just the surface. In fact, not often, always. It's always just the surface.
I was just thinking that my friend's son, who's now in theater at NYU, that he couldn't be the lead all the time. He would sometimes have to be the set and have to be the lighting. That's such a good perspective, too.
Right,
because
right.
You need to be behind the scenes.
Right, exactly. So I want us to think through that as we look at this. Because what we want to do, and this is every single time we study his word, is whose story is this anyway? Because what do we think? Right away, it's my story. So I come to Bible study to find out what God can do for me, or how God can fit into my life, or how we always look at it as my story. All of the Bible is God's story. It's about how he desires a relationship. And when we say no, he says, but I still desire it. And I'm going to make it possible for us to have a relationship. And the entire scriptures from Genesis on to Revelation is the story of him bringing back the possibility of relationship. And it's how he's doing it. So it's his story. It's interesting that Exodus, Robin, would you get me a drink of water? I feel my throat ready. Exodus begins, and it's always funny how they translate. I think, I don't remember how the first word is, but the first word, actual word in Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers is and. Why it's and is because it is the continuation of the story of Genesis, of the story of God refreshing what he originally intended, of him, thanks, Robin, of him bringing the covenant that he made into fruition. So, a lot of us studied Abraham during the summer. Most of us studied covenant last year. Let's see how much we remember from all of that. So, if Exodus is the continuation of the story of him fulfilling his restoration process through covenant, then I want to know what covenant is. Tell me, give me a definition of covenant. First, what's a good definition of covenant? Made by? Okay, so for those of you who didn't hear all that, a covenant is a solemn binding agreement. It's legal. And it's the most solemn and most binding agreement anyone has ever been able to make. And it has been throughout history. It's a solemn and a binding agreement. And it's made usually by cutting pieces of flesh, killing an animal, separating them, and walking in between. And what does that symbolic walk mean?
That if I don't,
how binding?
Death occurred to me if I do not keep my
good. So what the person is saying is, may death occur to me if I don't keep this agreement. So God is doing his restoration work through covenant, through a promise he's made that's so binding that God says, may you kill me if I don't keep this covenant. May you kill me if the covenant is broken in any way. And the covenant is not a covenant with us, but a covenant for us. So it is a covenant he makes on his own. So if we break it or he breaks it, he's promised that he will give his life, which we know has happened. We broke it. He gave his life. So that's the kind of nutshell covenant. What is the purpose of a covenant?
To give life.
So in the two parts we always say is to redeem from death and equip for life. Yeah, Kristen, I should have you giving this. It's always to redeem from death and to equip for life, which is exactly the picture of Exodus. They get redeemed from death, but then they're being equipped for life. So that's the whole thing. It is covenant being worked out. What is the basis of God's covenant? Love. Man's covenants usually, except for marriage, are based on
fear.
So, God's covenant based on love. What are the things that a covenant partner does for each other?
Support,
protection,
defend.
Mm-hmm. Protection, defend. Identity. So share life one with another. What else?
Growth,
provide for, right. So those are the basics. A covenant partner provides, protects, and shares life with. Those are the basic things that a covenant partner does. And everything God does, no matter where you find it in Scripture, no matter where you find it in your life, everything he does is based on this promise, this covenant. I have promised to redeem you from death and equip you for life. So all based on covenant. This is what we're seeing in Exodus, is his continuation of working out the covenant. What we saw in the summertime with Abraham is that he began the covenant with Abraham. He made the promise when Abraham did not know him, right? And he promises Abraham what?
Oh, that he will give him land forever and descendants.
Yep. And all the nations would be blessed through him, through the seed that he would give. And the seed would be the fulfillment of the covenant. The one person that would bring life and make it available to everyone. So that's the promise he gave to Abraham. So he begins to fulfill the promise to Abraham in Genesis. By how? How does he begin the fulfillment?
Giving him Isaac.
Right. Mm-hmm. He gives him Isaac in a miraculous way, and he shows him, out of what you consider death, a barren wife, an old man, I'm bringing life. And what you're going to see throughout Scripture is every time we say, well, this is death. This is death. God says, and I am the God who takes out of death and brings to life. So he looks at things completely differently because he is able to resurrect that which is dead. So that's what we're going to look at, is how he is continuing to fulfill. Because we don't have the seed yet, so he has to continue the descendants on down to bring life. It is a process, always a process, to redeem from death and bring to life. And so we have Isaac, and then he fulfills it even more by bringing Jacob, and then Jacob's 12 sons and their families. So that's kind of where we are in the process of God fulfilling covenant. So that's kind of our background for where we are. Everybody with us right now? Okay. Now do you understand, though, having studied covenant in Abraham, how much richer that makes the story of Exodus? How much richer that makes what's going on in here? Actually, that is going to be the underlying story of Exodus. So we can see the circumstances, we can see the story, but what the underlying thing is that he's working out covenant. Providing, protecting, and sharing life. That's what he's doing in all of that. So, that's what God is doing and working there. God's focus, though, is going to be his people. He wants to restore a people, a relationship of intimate fellowship. And he's going to choose a people. He's going to choose to build a people from the ground up. So he starts with, and just like we do, birthing a people. We see this birthing happening with Jacob, and then we bring it into Egypt, and we have this time of starting to grow his children. And the children will in turn become his body, just like our children do. And we go through these, and let's think about this. So we've got half of us at least on the cusp of having children that we've grown up, and now they're going out into the world to be our body, really, right? they're kind of going out there as our representatives. They came from our body, and now they're in the world to be our body. God says the same thing. I'm growing children to be my body in the world so that they will be fruitful and multiply and bring me more children. That's the whole story of what God is doing. That's what he did with Abraham. So that's what he's doing with his children, is growing them up to be his body so that they can be fruitful and multiply and bring him more children, more relationships of intimacy. So we have this big picture of God is working out covenant, but his focus is that he's creating a people. But he pays attention to, within that, individuals. And it should be amazing to you how many people he names by name in here. Particularly, if you'll notice, most of the names he names are actually not even Jews. So that's really interesting, and that should get your head thinking about what he promised in covenant. But he actually names them by name and gives them specific blessings because of their individuality. So lest we think that God is a big God and has no ability to pay attention to our little life, untrue. But it's the big God story going to our little story rather than how we look at it. We look at our story and then we kind of whittle it down to, well, how's God involved in our story, right? And he wants to flip it. And that's why he starts in Exodus right away. I want to show you this, how my story goes, so that you can understand. I love you, but it's my story. And you get a chance to be a part of my story. Which, I mean, just as I think several of you have children who've auditioned for plays, right? I remember some of you had. And it was a great thing if they actually got a part in a play, right? They wanted to be a part of the story, something bigger than them. That's the whole point. God says, hey, you got an opportunity to come with me and help play this restoration play, be in this restoration play with me. So, and he will do this. He will provide opportunities for individuals to come alongside of him in this restoration process. But he's going to do it in the most unlikely and unexpected ways. And he's going to choose to give opportunities. Really, he gives opportunities to all. But we're going to see the people that actually choose to come alongside of him are not going to be the people that we're going to choose. It's funny, when we say Moses, we think of this great man. But we're introduced to Moses at his lowest. I mean, he's a murderer. And like you said, premeditated. He's not this forthright person. It takes him 40 years to be humbled. That's who Moses is, but that's who God took to say, come alongside, you can help me restore the kingdom. So that's kind of where we are. So what I want us to do is I want us to go through the whole story again, and we're going to look at the layers of the stories. So we have the first layer, which is the circumstances we see and that aren't surprising to us. The second layer of the story is kind of the unexpected twist or turn in the story. Like, wow, now normally we wouldn't expect that to happen, a response to what happened or whatever. I mean, right away, if we begin the story with the Israelites being slaves in Egypt, right away we're going, well, that was unexpected. Although it was expected because we were told that. But still, we're thinking, but these are God's people. That would not be our expected first layer story, right? That's a second layer story because it's unexpected. And then we'll look at, well, what's really happening with all of this? That's the behind the scenes, what God is really doing, how he's working out covenant. And I really want us to begin to start thinking about all of life this way, that we look at our circumstances and that we're so involved in our circumstances that we forget that there's more layers and that there's an under, behind the scenes layer that's really the real story. That's really what's going on. Does that make sense to you? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay.
Yeah, I thought like when it says here, like the more and more they were afflicted, they multiplied. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about 9/11, maybe there will be a huge burst of 9-year-olds. Mm-hmm. They went back to church, they probably found solace with each other and had more children.
That would be a very interesting, to see if that came about. Mm-hmm. I do remember them portraying people who were pregnant during that time and the kids that came out of that.
All the baby boomers after World War II.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right. So, All right, so we're going to go through the first layer story. We're going to look at the unexpected response or happening with that. And here, I want you to put down all the things you know about Exodus, because if you don't, you will say, well, how is that unexpected? But it is, if this is the first time you ever heard the story of Exodus, that would be an unexpected thing that's happening. And then we'll look at what's behind the scenes. And that's really the most interesting and the most, wow, that is awesome. That's where we understand the definition of awesome, seeing that. So, all right, Exodus 1, 1 through 7. We have Jacob's sons leaving the promised land to escape famine. Okay, so they leave the promised land to escape famine. The second layer is that, well, unexpectedly, Joseph's there. Somehow, Joseph, who they sold, who they assumed would have been dead, is there, and not only is there, but he's in a position of prominence. He's the second highest official in Egypt, and he's able to provide and protect for his family. Not only does he provide and protect for them, their immediate, but because of Joseph and all he did in Egypt, and I can't wait when we study Joseph because I love that story. Not only is Joseph this wonderful person and he's able to provide for them, but because of Joseph's reputation, all of Jacob and his sons and his family, 70 people, are honored by the Pharaoh. And they are given, actually, the land of Goshen, which is a piece of Egypt. It will be a piece of the Promised Land, but it is a piece of Egypt at this point. It still is. And it is actually the most fertile piece of Egypt. And the Pharaoh gives these 70 people that land. And he gives them a beautiful place of fertility and a place that they can actually remain as one, as this family of 70. And while they're there, of course, this is not unexpected. They increase in number and in might, of course. That it's flourishing. The unexpected part of the story is that they were given this land, the best land, by Pharaoh. So we have that unexpected second layer. But what's the behind the scenes? What is God doing? How is he working out covenant here? Very, very interesting. And this is why I love history so much. One of the things he's doing is protecting them. Because at this time, and for the next hundreds of years, Israel, the promised land part of the Middle East, is a place of constant warfare. It is the north and the south coming through Israel constantly with warfare, 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 warfare. It is just in a state of chaos all the time. So, how well would this family of 70 people have done in a land where it's constantly being bombarded by warriors? Not well. Not well, right? Not well. So what's God doing? He's protecting this family so that they can grow. So politically, he's protecting them. He's also providing for them the ability to become cohesive as they grow into one nation. The country of Israel, geographically, is not a place that would naturally make a nation cohesive. It's very mountainous. There's lots and lots of different mountains, lots of different valleys. It's very separated, very similar to Greece, which is close by. During that time, Greece is also having lots of people growing. And what happens because they're in Greece, in that geographical location? Does anyone know the history of Greece? City-states, and they're all rival city-states, and they war against one another so that it's very difficult for them to ever become cohesive. It's funny because who's in the news right now with constant protests against their own government is Greece. I mean, Greece is a mess right now. That type of geography is not conducive to having a people grow cohesive. And since God is growing his people here from a small amount, from 70 to more, he is assuring that they become one nation. Not only does he take them out of the promised land for a time, but he brings them to a nation that wants to honor them by giving them their own land here for a while. Now, that looks a lot different, doesn't it? It's not just that there was a famine, but God knows what they need at what time. Interesting enough, by the time Israel finally gets into the promised land, when we get into Numbers, they're actually, for the first time in a long, in hundreds and hundreds of years, there's a vacuum of power in the north and in the south, and there's nobody going in and out of Israel. And this is a time when Israel comes in. So here's what I want us to see. When we look at the story of what's happening, don't stop there. God is working out his covenant, and he knows. He knows all of the things that his people will need and how he needs to protect them and not. We don't look at it. When we first see the story, we don't think that's a protection or a provision except for the immediate. No, this is a long term, 400 years for all of that to happen. So that's when they're being prosperous in Goshen. So now we jump to the next couple of verses, 8 through 14, and we have all of a sudden this Pharaoh that knew Joseph has died, and a new one comes along. Now he's an actual Egyptian Pharaoh that comes, and he doesn't know Joseph. He could care less about the Israeli people, but he sees that they are very large, that they're in a very fertile land, and he realizes they're going to be a threat to us. So we have to be careful. They needed them to stay there because why? This is kind of the debate now we have in our immigration stuff. We need their labor. At this point, they're not slaves yet, but we need their labor. We also need the fact that they help our economy in buying. They were needed there because, remember, they're prosperous there. They're probably the richer people there. They need them. So he's got to figure out a way to keep them there, but not let them be powerful. So, and understand this, the way they come into slavery is a gradual way. It's not like one day the Pharaoh wakes up and puts them in slavery. That wouldn't work. It becomes, it's a very gradual and kind of a natural thing. In fact, one thing we rarely look at is, okay, so God brings them there to prosper, and then he allows slavery to happen. How does that happen? What happens? We've done minor prophets enough. What happens to a people who become prosperous and have everything they need and are comfortable? What happens? They forget about God, right? It's exactly what happened to them. They forgot about God, and they began to assimilate into the Egyptian culture and the Egyptian gods. How do we know this? Because Ezekiel, funny that Ezekiel, way after the time, talks back. And God says, I told the Israelites in Egypt, get rid of those Egyptian gods, or I will need to get rid of them for you. And so...
And didn't we see that in Kings, too? Remember sitting in Kings, about the chariots.
Yep,
the horses,
exactly.
Egypt,
yes.
They would just allow that.
Right. So we have this people who are comfortable and rich in this new culture, and they start taking on the culture's ways, and they get comfortable, and now they're in a position where they don't want to leave, right? And so they begin to concede things, and they begin to syncretize their worship, and they begin to take in the Egyptian gods and the Egyptian ways, and you can see how the slide happens, that they don't want to let go of what they have. And so they let go of God and his ways. And it's a meshing of them falling into and the Egyptian coming on top of. So you understand now how the slavery might have happened? That it isn't just this, all of a sudden, this Pharaoh is so strong he can take it over.
In all the years.
It's the weakness of their faith in God coupled with the understanding of the world that there is power there. Those two things make for the slavery here.
How many years were they actually, like, oppressed?
Well, they began to be oppressed probably 30 years in.
Okay.
But the oppression wasn't immediate slavery. How do we oppress in this country? I mean, we don't have slaves now, right?
Economically.
Yeah, so economically.
Poor wages.
We start to expect more of them. Discrimination. Right, all of those kinds of things. So that's where the oppression starts.
Okay.
And it gets worse and worse and worse until they're in the point where they are absolute slaves. It was a very typical thing for a government to exact taxes, and if rather than taking money for taxes, they would require family or all of the males to work. So for your taxes this year, you have to work for 1 month. And then next year, the taxes would go up. And for this year, your taxes are going to be paid by you working 2 months for the government, which is what Pharaoh was doing. And that, so that it becomes this gradual thing, and all of a sudden, it looks like they're in slavery. So we have this gradual slavery thing where they're really choosing the death because they don't want to give up the worldly things. And God allows this because he needs for them to give up the ways of the world.
If they were
gods.
They were probably spending too much on their credit cards and you know, piling up debts.
And that's exactly what you should see. And we see this cycle in Israel over and over, and then we see it
in the world
over and over and over.
In that time, and that was for the government and the elitists to acquire it. I think, you know, if we compare it to today, it's so we can provide for the people who have less. I think that when people talk about the increase in taxes that's being paid for the big CEOs or the government officials or whatever else, it's to provide for the people who don't have.
If that were the case, that would be wonderful.
They
yes. Okay, so what happens as they're being oppressed? What's the unexpected story?
They multiply
even more. Somewhere I read 5 times more than they were multiplying. And this is a sociological fact. When people are oppressed, when they're in slavery, they increase tremendously. Why? Why would you increase more when you're oppressed? Exactly. It's exactly right. That's where you find your comfort. It's the only place for you that there's life, right? That's exactly right.
Didn't they also say at one point that during their slavery it built up their physical bodies?
Right.
And things, so that's
right.
Another thing going on.
So, and that's the behind the stories. What's God doing? He's working out covenant here. What's he doing? He's providing for them. He's protecting them. He's sharing life with them. In what ways? First of all, here's the interesting thing. Remember, when he works out covenant, it's not just for his chosen people, but all the nations, right? At this time, God says that the Amorite people are the ones in Israel, and they are wicked. They're the ones who God is Molech, and they give their babies to Molech. And he's saying to the Amalek people, give up those ways and come to me. He continues to say this, and every time a tribe is wiped out, it is because God's given them time to come to him and they've refused. At this time, the Amorites are not quite at their most detestable point. They're not at the point of no return. And so God is giving them time right now. During this time of slavery, God is also looking out for the nations, and he's giving them time. Come back to me. Come back to me. I want a relationship with you. And they're going farther and farther down. And what he's doing is giving them time, but preparing the Israelites to be God's hand of destruction for them, judgment. Now, the Israelites can't come and be judgment over them if they come in prideful. That doesn't work. He's got to humble them first in order to be his hand, because God only works that way, with humility. So that's one of the things he's doing. He's also humbling them in this way. They have lost their sense of need. And anytime we lose our sense of need, we lose a view of the spiritual reality, which is really what's going on. So for us, this is a big deal. When we lose our sense of need, we lose sight of what is spiritually true, of the reality. And what's the reality? That God is working covenant out right now. Remember, I'm right now working out covenant. And when we don't have needs, when we don't see our needs, we lose that, because we have no need to look for that.
Yeah.
That, what's he doing here? This feels like death, but I remember he said he's giving me life. But if I feel comfortable, I'm not going, God, what are you doing? You said you're bringing life, and this looks like death, but I know you're bringing life. I don't have any need to look for that.
Mm-hmm. Today was senior at the pool, and my daughter was pretty apathetic about going in it, and it did occur to me, I'm like, if there was something desperate at your high school or in our mm-hmm. country, you would be the first one there.
Yes.
But
yes.
We are. We're just so comfortable. There's
right.
My daughter's not desperate to pay
right.
for school.
Exactly.
It seems
exactly.
Fine.
Right. Right. It seems, and that's the thing. That's the trap, is we only look at that first level story. It is God brings us to places of need, brings us to the places of wilderness, so we understand there's more going on here, and I want what's going on here. I'm pretty sure that God will give us opportunity after opportunity. It's that we have eyes to
well,
see
you
it.
Need to be thankful. You need to look
yep.
for these
yep.
things.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's pitiful, but it does take a desperate
yes.
feeling to get to that point
right.
because we should be having different eyes.
Okay. Another thing that God is doing. Did you have a question?
I was just reading this morning in James, actually. And to back what she just said, I mean, in James, I read James 5, I don't know, towards the end of it. It says, when things are going bad, pray. But when things are happy, things are going good, just praise the Lord.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So. Yep. Make sure you're looking at that bottom line. While God is working, I'm seeing some of the results
mm-hmm.
of covenant
mm-hmm.
rather than just the workings. Yes, yes, exactly. It's why the memorial stuff is so important. And in fact, how are we introduced to him in these chapters? He gives us his memorial name, I am. So another thing that he's doing is that he's giving them an experience of suffering so that they understand their need. Because without the experience of suffering, we rarely understand our need. Not only that, not only in the experience of suffering do they understand their need, but they also see the falseness of a transactional life. In other words, what they see is living the world's way, there will always be part of the world that will have to be oppressed. Because transactions always come out one person better than the other. So that these transactional living, there's going to be oppression. And oppression is not wonderful. It's not fun. It's not beautiful. And they need to experience that so that they can go and be God's body. Because what is God concerned about? Justice, right? And what do we know about justice? It's about giving life to those who are oppressed. And they can't be God's body and have that heart for oppression if they've never been oppressed. So God is providing for them what they need to be his body, right? He is equipping them for life. So we look at this slavery time and we think, oh! And we have to see a lot of different things in here, what God is doing. And here's the interesting thing. What he's doing something with their choice to choose death. And that's important that we see that because they didn't need to stay in slavery for 400 years. Because they could have said, hey, we're getting too comfortable. Let's return to God, right? They always have that opportunity. And they didn't. And so God says, oh, you didn't choose life, but I'm gonna use your choice to bring life. Isn't that amazing? That God will use our sin to bring us life. And that's what I mean by looking at that underside story. So that when there are people in our lives that are choosing sin, when we're choosing sin, we don't have to be, oh, we can go, wow, and God will use that too.
What do you mean some people have a higher temperature that they need to choose life than others?
And that is very true.
It's so
it is very true.
People
yeah.
wait till the pain is so
yes.
bad before they
yes.
life.
That is very true. That is very true. So this is what he's doing. This is the understory, the behind-the-scenes story is God's working out covenant all along. So when we look at these things in Scripture, we need to look at the things in our lives and go, God is working. It is not a matter of us going, I'm just resigned to the fact that, my child is choosing poorly or I'm choosing poorly or somebody else in my life is choosing poorly. I'm not resigned to that because faith is not resigned. Faith knows that God is working covenant. Right now, in the choosing, he's working covenant. And that's the amazing thing about God. And the unexpected thing is that he uses not just what his plans are, but our choices. He's this God who gives us choices, says, you can choose life, you can choose death. Oh, you want to choose death? Okay, I'll use that too. Just like, what does Joseph end his Genesis with? I mean, what's the speech Joseph gives at the end of Genesis? You meant for evil, but God meant for good. And I have to read it to you because we always end it there. We always say, you meant evil, God meant good, but it actually has one more thing to it, which I even forgot and thought, yeah. Let me read it to you. Genesis 50. And as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. What is the purpose of covenant? To preserve life. That's what he's doing. So he takes our poor choices and uses them to preserve life for many people. So this is what he's doing here. So let's go on. I mean, it gets more and more fascinating. We now have all the young men, the males of Israel, become threats. Why? Why all of a sudden are the males threats? Why not the females? Why not everybody? Why not just kill the whole people? Exactly, because they could be warriors that will come up.
And women can't multiply without the men.
Exactly. So we have the midwives are ordered to kill the newborns. But what's the unexpected part of that story?
They don't.
We have Egyptian midwives who don't kill them. Why?
They fear God.
Okay, all of a sudden we're like, what? That's weird. How did that happen?
Life into the world all the time.
Yep, exactly. Because what does the scripture say? That all of nature proclaims that God is God. Also, if they are midwives, they most likely spend more time where?
With the Hebrews.
With the Hebrews, right? Mm-hmm. So where are they learning now some of the truths that they know from the Hebrews?
And maybe also God was making the deliveries easier for the Hebrew women
yes.
than the Egyptians.
Yes. I believe
maybe
that.
They're not, you know, lying. Or
right.
Maybe it really is true. Like,
right.
Oh, they so easily bring forth children.
Right.
You know?
Right. And it would be true when they said they're very hardy and they go fast. Well, of course they're hardy because guess what? They're workers. You know, I what is the book The Great Pearl where she has the baby in the field as she's working?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Good Earth.
The Good Earth. The Good Earth. The Good Earth. That probably was very, very close to reality as well.
Oh my God.
Sure. So we have this unexpected thing. The midwives save the babies. They don't just save individual babies, though. Let's bring it higher. They save a whole generation of males. A whole generation they save. When the scripture names these two midwives, most likely, when they name them, most likely they were like the overseers of all the midwives. So it wasn't just two individual midwives, it was the head midwives they're kind of overseeing, so that a whole generation gets saved of male Hebrew boys.
Isn't that cool? Because women are so relational, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, it's
yep.
not an accident that God
exactly.
shows
exactly.
midwives mm-hmm.
and we continually see, and even from the very beginning, is God uses women over and over again for the restoration process. The interesting thing is that these midwives are pagans. They're Gentiles. But what's the covenant again?
Didn't they have their own midwives?
I thought they were Hebrew midwives.
No. No. These are Egyptian midwives. These are Egyptian midwives. What was the covenant promise?
For all nations.
So what we see all over Scripture is God continually giving the covenant to the Gentiles. To the rest of the world. So we see this happening here a little bit, and we're going to see really one of the really interesting things come later in Exodus.
So John,
yeah.
Sorry. In Exodus 1, verse 15, then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives.
Oh.
What, did he mean the midwives?
Yeah.
So that could be read two different ways.
Yes, it could be read two different ways, yes.
If they were Hebrew.
Yes, right.
But
he no.
must have had their own midwives.
Okay, because what do they say to, what's the explanation they give
one
to the king?
One was named Shiphrah,
Ephra, and the other was named Pua.
But what's the explanation they give?
That they have their babies so quickly.
Right, exactly.
So the Hebrew women would not go and deliver the Egyptian
no.
babies, so it had to be
right.
Egyptians
right. Right. And of course, you're going to do that because of what Pharaoh wants done. He's not going to let the Hebrews deliver their own babies. Right.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Okay. So we have, what is he doing here? What is God doing? What's the underlying story, the behind the scenes story? God is protecting the covenant line, right? Because the line, the seed, has not come yet. So he's protecting the line that, and his people, that they would continue to grow. He's making sure of that. So when the midwives won't do it, now he charges all of his people to do it. Now it's not just the midwives' job, but it's all Egyptians are supposed to, if they hear a baby's crying, because now he thinks, well, they're going to get born. But if any Egyptian has any contact and sees or hears a baby crying, then it's their job to kill the babies. What's the unexpected thing, though? We have Moses being born, right? Moses, what line does he come out of? Okay, so he's a Levite. He gets born, and he gets hidden. Why does he get hidden? Because now everyone's after him. If he wouldn't have gotten hidden, none of the other stuff would have happened. So we have Moses being hidden. What do most of your translations say he's hidden in? A basket. Yeah, the word is ark. He's hidden in an ark, which is why we have our reed basket here. And that, it looked more like that, that little ark. Because ark means a box that saves. Noah's ark. And that's what the reader should, when they read that, go, oh, Noah's ark, first covenant. Oh, yeah. Place of saving. A place, interesting enough, because the last part of Genesis, the last verse, says that Joseph died at the age of 110 years and he was embalmed and placed in a ark. It says coffin here, but the word is ark. He's placed in an ark in Egypt. Well, interesting. It's a place where what looks like death will be saved and come to life.
Does he believe? Bring me back to the land because I know the covenant
yes.
is going to be fulfilled.
Exactly. Exactly. So we have Moses being placed in an ark. A place of what looks like death. I mean, this looks like, it looks like Jochebed is putting the baby in and going, you know, that baby's probably dead.
I think it's interesting that Pharaoh listened to his daughter instead of saying, a Hebrew baby will kill him, you know. Yeah.
Well, here's one of the things you need to know, and this is why really you need to understand history when you read scripture. Most likely, it's not Pharaoh's daughter. It's probably one of his many granddaughters. Remember how in scripture all the time, during that whole time, it's Pharaoh is, you know, the guy up here, but he's got lots of children. Remember, how many children do you think he has? He's got harems galore. He's got lots of children, and he's got lots of grandchildren. And they believe most likely that she was a grandchild, and that he probably had very little contact with that. He may have known, or it wasn't just, you know, let her have her little toy, kind of.
Okay, if Pharaoh had all the harems and stuff, do you have multiple wives, too?
Pharaoh, yes. Yeah.
Okay. He may not have told him that she drew him out of the water.
Right.
He may not have known that he was a Jew.
So, all we know is that Pharaoh, somebody living within Pharaoh's palace, home, takes Moses and takes him out of this ark. Here's the really interesting thing. Another unexpected thing. We not only have Pharaoh's daughter finding Moses in the little reed ark, but what does she say to the sister who's watching?
That he's beautiful.
That he's beautiful. And what is the daughter, the sister?
You need somebody to nurse him.
Do you need somebody to nurse him? I'll go and get a wet nurse for you. Sounds like a great plan, doesn't it? By the way, this little girl who says that is Miriam. So we see Miriam coming up. So we have Miriam bringing Jochebed, his Moses' mother, and Moses' mother gets to nourish his own son and raise him to at least the age of 3. Interesting, though, here's the more unexpected thing. What else?
She got paid.
She gets paid!
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's God doing? He's providing for Moses' whole family. Why? Because he's also raising up Aaron and Miriam to help lead, right? As it comes. So he needed to provide for this family beyond being just slaves. So here they get this enormous provision, which probably helps Aaron to rise up to leadership within that slave community. So, what do we have going? God working out covenant in so many different ways. Because of this, Moses knows his heritage. He has grown up for 3 years at least, and perhaps more, with his Jewish parents and his Jewish family who are teaching him Jewish ways, right? So he understands his heritage here, if nowhere else. But then we, of course, have him going into the palace of Pharaoh, and we know from Acts that he had all of the Egyptian learning, which is a big deal because at this point, Egypt is the power of the world. It has all the culture. It has all of the scientific knowledge. In fact, there's a lot of scientific and other knowledge that Egypt had that we still don't have. We don't have their knowledge of dyes. We don't know how to get the brilliant colors still. We don't have their knowledge of, oh, I just lost it. There's a couple, there's at least 3 places that we still don't have the knowledge. Embalming. Oh, embalming. Embalming, that's one of them. We know how to embalm, but not like they did. They, think about it. We have mummies still that still have intact things inside. They have all sorts of this. So this is what Moses gets raised in. All of the Egyptian learning. So he learns all of the things they have. And the complete culture, the complete learning, all of these things he is learning.
And so the other thing that he's learning too, though, which is amazing to me, is if they had a culture that didn't like the Hebrews,
mm-hmm.
he was hearing a lot of things about these terrible Hebrew
right.
people.
Right.
Which I find very amazing
mm-hmm.
that he didn't like assimilate that.
Right, exactly. So he does, he learns, he hears the prejudices, he hears all of that. He also has the privileges of royalty here. So he's got a lot of understanding of not just knowledge, but leadership skills. He understands, what he understands a lot of is transactional living. He really understands that he's in power and those people aren't. And then it begins, as we see God bringing him along, we begin to see that there's going to be a clash here between the privileged and the oppressed. And what do we do about this? So what do we have here? What's God doing behind the scenes? He's providing a picture, first of all, of the true deliverer to come. So remember how God always gives us pictures of what it's going to look like when the covenant is completely fulfilled, what it's going to look like? Moses is one of those pictures. I'm going to show you a little bit of what the deliverer is going to look like. He's going to look like someone who was royalty, who grew up in royalty. And then we'll see what else happens. He's protecting the life of the one he's chosen to deliver them, to do part of the restoration. So he's protecting that and the way of deliverance, and we'll look at that in a while. But he's also training him and preparing him as a leader. So he's giving Moses what he's going to need to help bring life for all the Hebrew people.
It's
so
the coolest thing, because, I mean, here's a burning bush. You become a, I don't think he'd, think, I mean, what's that burning bush at?
Right.
Whoa. But I just love how he says, not me.
Yeah, we're not at that point yet, right? Because right now we're at Moses' point of, I have everything, I'm smart, and it says that he was eloquent in words, which is interesting, and deeds. So he was very, very endowed with many good qualities, but qualities that came to be actually qualities of pride, as we'll see in a minute here. All of that God's using to train him as a leader, so that we see at some point Moses hates pride. In fact, the New Testament says Moses was one of the most humble people. Not yet, but he'll get there, because the fall from this to this is huge. And so we understand a little bit more of what made Moses Moses and what God was doing. So we go on to chapter 2, and we have now Moses' arrogance. He, from what we understand in the New Testament, Moses does believe that he's going to deliver his people. And we don't know at what how he knows that, but he believes he's supposed to deliver his people. And so he goes out to watch. And think about this. He goes out as a prince, and he goes and he watches his oppressed people. And he's feeling like, I'm the one. I can do this. I am going to deliver my people. And how does he do it?
Not well.
Not well, right? He kills, because pride always brings about death. And so we have Moses' pride causing him to decide he can deliver on his own his people. He can do God's work for God. And so he kills, and he's not so, here's the thing. He's not so concerned that he killed, but that he could be killed right now. Pharaoh isn't so concerned that he killed. Because really?
He doesn't care about killing. He's allowed people.
Right. He's not concerned about killing. What's he concerned about?
That he's going to protect the Hebrews.
Exactly. That he is going to switch sides and become a leader of the Hebrews. So that's what Pharaoh's concerned about. Pharaoh is always concerned about keeping his power, right? That's what he's concerned about. So he's after Moses. And what we see, though, in the defense is when Moses kills, and then he goes to his people and says, hey, you shouldn't be arguing with one another. Don't you know what I just did? I just killed for you. You got to get along. And what do his people do? They turn on him. They reject him.
Don't you think that maybe when he saw his Hebrew brother being beat up, that maybe he didn't realize his strength, that it wasn't... I don't know who am I going to kill today?
No, because he said he looked left and he looked right.
But then he sees this guy getting beat up.
he could have just...
Yeah, right. You know what? He was the prince. He could have done many things. He did murder. And now he's murdered an Egyptian, and now the Israelites say, well, we don't want anything to do with you. He's rejected by his own people. Are we seeing the picture? We have a prince come down to help, rejected by his own people.
Do his people know he's one of them?
Yes. Yes, because Aaron and Miriam are his sisters. Aaron is one of the leaders already. So yes, he does.
But I think that is a surprise that they would reject
yes,
him.
Yes, it is.
But it may be a testament to who he was as a person at that time, that
right.
he wasn't very trustworthy.
Right.
And so,
right.
yeah.
He was still taking
just,
out.
They're
right.
not buying it
right.
into this.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
He could do anything tomorrow.
Right. He's still about himself. He's still living a transactional life here.
Well,
that's exactly it.
They could have rejected him because they weren't really honoring God, and they could have been jealous that he had more than them.
Right, right. I mean, all sorts of things here. But we're kind of surprised because we know the story and we're thinking, oh, they reject him, but he's going to deliver you. Well,
not that way.
God doesn't want him to deliver that way. So what is God doing? What's the behind-the-scenes story? First of all, he's providing experience to Moses that you cannot deliver on your own. You cannot do my work for me. And this is a place that we always get in trouble. I will do God's work for him. God doesn't need us to do his work, actually. He invites us to come along, come with him, and do his work with him. But he doesn't need us to do his work for him. If you ever think you're doing something for God, whoa, stand back and think about Moses. So he's giving me experience. I don't need you, Moses. I'd love for you to come along with me while I deliver, but I really don't need you to do it on your own. He's also almost forcing a choice. Moses, now you got a choice. You can no longer stand in the middle. You can't be both Egyptian and Israel, Hebrew. You can't be both. You got to choose now. Do you want to be part of my people, or do you want to be part of the world's people? Which one? This is a choice now. And this is what God is doing with allowing Pharaoh to go over and kill him.
Isn't that just like the Old Testament verse about, like, choose this day?
Yes. It's always, God says, I give you life, I give you death. Mm-hmm. Choose either one, because I'm going to use it for covenant anyway. But choose. And he's making Moses choose at this point. Now you got to choose. It's time that you get off the fence, is really what he's doing for him.
I love the Hebrews verse that we had to look up from the Hall of Fame chapter, mm-hmm. and, you know, about talking about his spiritual life, that he was looking ahead to the Savior.
Yes, yes.
How do they know that?
Amazing, amazing that this point Moses actually chooses. And think about this. This would be as if you are here and you choose to go be a martyr somewhere. I'm willing to give up my life here in my nice Naperville home with enough food, more than enough food, and lots of friends, and I'm going to go be a place where no one likes me, and I'm going to a place where people are going to just be really ugly to me. I'm going to choose that. And this is Moses, and he's choosing that. So here we have this growth and understanding of something bigger than him, and it's not the world's ways that's bigger than him. So we go on to see that Moses flees. And where does he flee to?
Midian.
He flees to a pagan people, a Gentile people. Now, does anybody remember where Midianites came from? Oh, man, this isn't that long ago, guys.
What did you, I didn't hear that.
Where did the Midianites come from? Wow.
Abraham's second wife.
There you go. Keturah. No. Abraham's wife Keturah had Midian.
Wait. Abraham's second wife?
Yes, after Sarah died.
Remember, he married, and it was like all the princes of the east.
I guess I missed that.
Yep. You missed the last one. Yes. Yes. Abraham married again after Sarah died, and he had several other children, and one of them was Midian. So.
But were they really pagan? I mean, they were worshiping God on Mount Sinai there.
They were not. Later they will, but not right now. They are a pagan people at this point. What's happened to many of the children of Abraham that weren't under the covenant because they weren't from the line of Isaac?
Right.
They have chosen to go with the world. So at this point, Midianites are a pagan people. They have a pagan way of looking at things. They worship a pagan god. And we'll find out later that they actually will change. But at this point, they are. But it's interesting that he runs to actually a Semitic people.
Don't they not get along, the Jews and the Semitic people?
Jews are Semitic.
Oh, no, I'm thinking of
Semitic. So it's still in his family line. So it's very interesting that God, again, is protecting the line, isn't he? That he's still in the Semitic people. So he goes out there, and God provides this opportunity for him to run to a people that are, first of all, pagans, and second of all, shepherds, you know, nomads. This brings the opportunity for beginning to learn humility. Right? If this is the only place he can go. In fact, in other words, it says he has no friends in Egypt and no friends in Israel's camp.
So what does Semitic mean? From Abraham? Anyone born of Abraham?
Yeah. Anybody born from Abraham is Semitic.
Anyone.
Yeah.
So even the Ishmaelites?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. They're Semitic.
I thought it was like a synonym for Jew all these
years. It's bigger than Jew. Yeah, it's bigger than Jew.
Most Middle Eastern.
Shem. It actually comes from Shem, from the line of Shem.
Oh,
it comes
from
that.
From Noah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the Shem, they were Shemites, Semites. That's how it comes.
So he went from like the, I mean, look at this, when you just said shepherd, like
Royalty.
Yep.
To
like, okay, you're down here.
Yeah.
Humbleness.
Yeah. So what do we have? We have a prince rejected by his people. Go. Becomes a shepherd, goes to...
You know what, it seemed like, like right before the burning bush, he was pretty okay with it.
Well, yeah, we got 40 years before burning bush, though.
He was a shepherd, and he was doing
okay.
Yeah, but do you think the day he ran away he was okay?
No.
You think the day he ran away he was like, oh, man, I am nothing.
But I truly think he was humbled.
In 40 years. Yeah. It took him 40 years. Yes.
Shepherds despised
Moses. Yes, shepherds were despised in Egypt. Shepherds were, nope. I mean, still, you know, there are still nomad shepherds in the Middle East. And even in the Middle East, they're not. Remember that there was a little girl that was named after Lissa in Syria?
Mm-hmm.
They were a nomadic family.
Yeah.
So they were very poor and not considered, you know, they were definitely refugees and not considered much.
Well,
so
even in our culture, we hear people
yeah.
like gypsies,
mm-hmm.
killers, like, you know,
yep.
people move around a lot. Like,
yep.
There's not a real positive connotation.
Right. So this is where Moses runs. So now we have Moses running to Midian, and the first thing he encounters is a well. How many times is well going to come up over and over and over again? Why? What's the picture of a well? It gives life, right? It gives life. So we have this, and every time we see this, we should think, what's God doing here? He's giving life. He's giving life. And so we have Moses actually already have this humbleness that he is going to help these shepherdesses. So it's the girls who are out shepherding, and they are being not attacked,
yeah,
but
harassed
and hassled, and Moses helps them, brings them water, and we know basically what is the unexpected thing that leads from that.
He gets married.
Yeah. He finds a place to live. He finds a home and a family.
Do you think I know this is the culture of the arranged marriages and
mm-hmm.
all of that. Do you ever wonder if, like, she wanted to marry him?
Man, I don't know. I don't think that. I don't think that would ever even occur to anybody in the story, including her.
Yeah,
like, that's
like
just not a part of it.
Yeah.
He was a prince, yeah. That's true.
I mean, I know that wasn't the culture to think of that wasn't part of it, but I don't know, the counselor in me just wondered what she's feeling.
I know.
And if her dad blessed it.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And that's right. Since he arranged it, it was probably, you know, she probably felt fairly good. Although we have places where that's not true. So what's the underneath story? What's the behind the scenes story? What's God doing for 40 years? Because we don't have anything for 40 years. All we know is he acquires a home and a family for 40 years in the wilderness, becomes a shepherd. What's God doing? He's providing a beautiful wilderness training for him. Desert survival skills, right? For 40 years, he learns how to live in the desert. Which is really interesting, isn't it? Considering for the next 40 years, he's going to live in the desert and he's going to have to lead people how to live in the desert for 40 years. Isn't that amazing? See, this is the thing. Again, think about your life. Stop looking at this top layer as if this is the real story. It's not the real story. The real story is God working out covenant here. I'm sure that we were talking about that in Philippians, yes. Yeah. Always, 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 because that's who he is. He wants to give life. So he's also giving experience as an alien and an exile, which is very helpful for him to understand that because he knew nothing of being an alien and exile, really. He's providing also, what does the wilderness always provide us? Time away from the voices of the world. Time away from the culture of the world so that he now has space and time to hear God. Because I really don't think he would have heard God in the burning bush if the burning bush would have been in Egypt 40 years back. He would have thought, oh, the magicians did a great thing. And now he has the time and the space to be able to hear God. And he also provides, remember, it's not just about the chosen people, but about the whole world. He provides an introduction, a covenant, to this Gentile family of Jethro's family, of Zipporah's family. So we have all sorts of things going on here underneath, which is really where we should go, wow, this is so cool what God is doing. And he is the God named I Am. I am doing this right now. I'm doing this in your life, in all your individual lives. I'm doing this. Same kinds of things. So we go on to... now, at the very end of that chapter, we have God saying, I hear Israel's cry, right? Israel cries and sighs because of their bondage. And they have gotten to the point where they're crying out to God, realizing this isn't life and I can't get out of it on my own. This is where God wants them. Why? So they understand their need, so that they will begin to see the spiritual reality. So, what's the unexpected? The unexpected is, after 400 years, God hears their groaning, as if he didn't hear them before, or perhaps they weren't groaning before. Mm-hmm. They didn't like it. They might have been grumbling and complaining, but they weren't calling out to God. They weren't crying out to God, which is often us. We get into a bad situation and we, oh, I hate this, instead of, God, would you help me here? And then it says God remembers his covenant. Had he forgotten his covenant? No. And why do we know that? Because we keep seeing his covenant being worked out over and over and over again.
It's unexpected that he hears their groaning. I mean, he told Abraham years ago that they would
right.
be in Egypt 400 years and mm-hmm. God
right.
would take them out.
What I want you to step back and pretend you've just heard this for the first time. You've just heard Exodus story for the first time. If Exodus was just presented to you without knowing the background, you would think, wow, well, for 400 years there hasn't been a God for them, and all of a sudden he's hearing them. That seems unexpected, all of a sudden, that this God just pops up. We know because of what was behind it, right? They have forgotten this.
Because they just asked for him.
Yeah, but...
they didn't ask for him for those first
That's
years,
exactly
probably.
Right. That's right. So all of this, the fact that they didn't ask, and that he's waited 400 years, is unexpected, and yet, because we know what's come before,
yeah,
and we know the underneath.
They know through the traditions and everything, the story.
But what's happened to
them?
They've forgotten God over and over and over again. They've forgotten God. They've forgotten what he said and promised. And, really, let's think about it humanly. After 400 years, you're thinking, maybe after 100 years. I mean, think about this. This country is not that old.
Our country, our country is only...
Yes.
Yes.
Our education system was founded so that children might know to read the Bible.
Yes, exactly.
That's why we had a free education.
That's exactly right.
And the Bible was banned.
Is banned
from our school.
Right.
So there it is.
I feel like right now I do not know nearly as much as a writer in the 1800s knew about religion.
Absolutely, and that is so true. That's so true.
They studied the Bible, and now you go to college and they teach you to be a pagan.
Right.
So they didn't have rabbis or any kind of religious
they gave it all up. Remember what we said, there's always a remnant.
Yeah.
There's a remnant within Israel.
Right.
There's remnant in Israel. And how do we know that? Because really, that whole generation that the two midwives saved, that whole generation, except for two, dies out because they did not believe God. And we'll get there in Numbers. But there's two that still believe. Who is it?
Joshua and Caleb.
So there's your remnant. So it's their line that has believed all along. So there's all God says,
well,
he will always save
the
remnant.
Must have believed also, that's
yes.
Why they
yes.
tried to save Moses.
Yes.
They recognized him.
It said that they knew, how do you say, like, they knew he was blessed.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's always a remnant. But the majority of Israel has given up. And now they're saying, well, we can't get out of this. No, maybe God is our answer here. Okay. So we have God hearing, God remembering. And when he says remembers the covenant, it's not that he's forgotten. This is, I'm giving homage to outright what I've been doing. Does that make sense? That kind of a remembering. And he sees, when it says he sees them as children. And that is really important. He knows that he has brought them up from the ground up and they're still children. And he sees them with tenderness and compassion. And when it talks about God knows their oppression, and the knows is experience or feel or understands, feels like a parent feels of their oppression. I understand, man, they made bad choices. But they're children, and I need to bring them life. So this is what God is doing. What is underneath that? He's providing for them evidence of his faithfulness to covenant. Because once they start crying out to God, all of a sudden now God's on their radar. What do we know about God? Anybody know anything about God? And pretty soon, they're going to be, that story's going to come back. Oh, that's weird. Wow, 400 years ago, he said we were going to be enslaved in Egypt for 400 years. Wow, that's weird. Didn't know that. No one passed that down to me. So they will begin to see that. And they'll begin to see that not only did God tell them that, but that God has now accomplished it. So they're beginning now, just having these glimmers of, oh, God really has been with us all this time, and we didn't even know it. Their sighs also indicate that they are now recognizing that their life there has been death. Beginning, because they don't do a really good job of recognizing it, but they're beginning to. They're beginning to understand that the transactional living that they've had when it was good and when it was bad in Egypt is always bad. It's always death. And their cries signal finally a readiness. So God says, I'm giving you this opportunity. Are you ready? Are you ready to come with me? Are you ready to acknowledge that I'm here for you and with you? Okay, so we now go on to Exodus 3, and we have Moses coming to the burning bush. Where is he, by the way, when he sees Mount the burning Horeb bush? Mount Horeb, which is Mount Sinai. Same place. So we understand that Moses has grown up and shepherded, has matured and shepherded in the place around Mount Sinai, which is really interesting, that he knows that area quite well. What's the unexpected thing? And this is unexpected if you were Moses and if you were the people hearing this. God calls Moses by his name. For the first time, we have God calling Moses by his name. Why is this unexpected to the people at that time? God didn't call you by your name. You were nothing. You weren't an individual to them. You're just somebody to appease them, right? This is, remember, you have to think about the understanding of gods at the time. And still to the Egypt, to the Hebrew people, this God, and for Moses, is still only one of many gods. But this God calls him by name. Moses, Moses. And we hear this over and over again, don't we? In different scripture places where God calls by name. Because he is a God who pays attention to the individual. And so he's issuing Moses the beginning of the invitation of, you want to come with me to help reconcile the world? You want to be part of this? He calls him by name. But then, it's more unexpected, he says, Moses, Moses. Basically saying, come on here. And then he goes, oh wait, no, no, don't come near me. Don't come near me. And then he says, take off your shoes. Now, we'll get to your question. It was, Moses would have absolutely understood this, because it was common practice in all the temples of the day that before you go into a temple of any god, you took off your shoes to signify that it was a holy place. But what's different about this God? Where is he?
He's in a bush.
He's in a bush. He's in the wilderness. He is in no place made by man. And what God is doing right now is, Moses, come here. I want you to recognize wherever I am is holy ground. And I'm not in a place in a building. I'm not in just a geographical place. Because remember, what God has to do is reintroduce and teach them to who he is. Because they only know a God by what the Egyptians have taught them. And here he says, I am a God who has no boundaries. And wherever I'm at is holy. That has a lot of implications for us and for them. If this is God who's calling us to be with him, then every place is holy. And all of life is sacred. All of life is spiritual. There is not a spiritual and a secular. And this is what God is doing. He's beginning to teach him about the fact that every place is sacred and spiritual. And all of life is spiritual because wherever God is holy. So does that make the taking off the shoes?
And even today, like when we went to Cambodia to the Temple of the Emerald Buddha,
yep, you take your shoes off.
And then yep. My kids put their feet to the Buddha, and they quickly got
thrown
out.
I'm
and
sure.
And Buddha underneath.
Oh, yes, right. No, no,
oh,
no.
I thought you meant they reached out and put their foot on it.
No, no, we were in a big room.
I was like,
just pointing your feet toward where a Buddhist is an insult.
Yes. Yes.
So that you always don't, when you sit across from somebody, you never sit with your legs pointing.
Yep. Which, I mean, and think about this. Because everything here, we can go deeper and deeper. What does Christ do?
He washes.
He does everything opposite to say, I am not what you think a God is. I am so totally different. I am so transformational. I am not what you think. So we have him, God calling Moses by name. He tells him not to come too close. Why? He's a child still. Moses is still a child, and he's giving him boundaries to help him. But what do we know about Moses later on? Moses is able to come to him face to face. He can come completely close to him. So we know that those boundaries are temporary for them to learn the holiness of God. And so Moses is the first one to have a boundary and then have it lessened. So what is God doing underneath this? First of all, he's establishing intimate relationship, which is what he's all about. He's going to start with one. This is all how he always did it. He did it with Abraham. He's going to start with one, and that one should multiply so that others are able to come to him with relationship. And how does he start establishing a relationship? Just how we do. We reveal our character to someone. So we start a relationship by revealing what makes us live. So I walk in here and I see Karen talking to Pam. And what are they? They're all of a sudden they're sharing right away. They're both artists. They get their and right away there's this connection. And so God is sharing with Moses, I'm going to show you who I am. I'm going to open myself up to you because I want a relationship with you. Okay? This is something a God wouldn't do, right? The gods of Egypt, the gods of the world at this time, they don't open themselves up to a relationship, even in the minds of the people who make up these gods and idols. And he wants Moses to be able to relate to him. And so they begin to have this understanding that they can share with one another what they're about. And that's key for what happens next. He also provides for him this recognition of how different he is, how transcendent he is, because he's showing Moses, man, wherever I am, is holy. I am so different than what... So start erasing what you know of God or gods. Okay, so we have Moses seeing the burning bush, and now God reveals to him his name. First of all, he says, I am the God of your father. Now that's really interesting, because Moses has been brought up now, has lived with two pagan families. He's lived with the Egyptian Pharaoh family, and now he's lived with Jethro's family. And so we have him having lived in two pagan families with different fathers, and God says, no, I'm the God of your father. And right away he says, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, no, I'm bringing you back to who you really are. And that kind of goes back to our study even this summer, is God is always calling you who you really are, not who you look like. You're not a prince. You're not a shepherd. You're actually mine, and I'm your God. And so he gives him that name for him. This is the point where Moses also will begin to understand that he, Moses, is not the deliverer. But it is the God of the covenant, because this is the covenant name that he's giving him. Oh, he's the God of the covenant. There's a promise somewhere. And remember, all the people, Egyptians included, would have understood covenant. He understands that practice. So what's the unexpected story is that God tells Moses what he's seen and felt. That's unexpected because gods don't do that. It's unexpected that a God would have a conversation, let alone say, I know what you're going through and I feel it. I'm compassionate. I have passion for that. And then he tells him his plans. And gods don't do that either. So here's all these unexpected things for Moses to kind of grapple with. Wow, here's this God talking to me in relationship, and now he's telling me what he's going to do. Wow. See, so from when Moses at the beginning decided he was going to deliver his people for God, he didn't really think much of that, because he would never have thought that the God would have told him this is how I'm going to do it. This is how you're going to come into the picture. But now we have God telling him how it's going to happen, that he's going to deliver his people from death, and he's going to bring them to life in a good land. What's he doing here? For Moses, he's giving him that name because that is the touchstone for Moses. That's that memorial. When he says, this is my memorial name, it is, come back to this. Come back to this. Remember, 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 I'm the God of covenant. I am the God who is faithful to covenant for 1,000 generations. Remember that, because this is, when Kathy had asked, so how do we stay in that place when we're in prosperous times, when we're in comfortable times? We go back to the name. Oh, he's the God of covenant. Right now, even, he's working out covenant. That's the touchstone for Moses. Come back to this all the time, that he's working out covenant. And that plays in a lot of the times when Moses is leading, that Moses is able to go back to that. And he's assuring him that he, God, is the defender, not Moses. That Moses is actually just going to be with God as he delivers. That it's God who's doing it. It's his strength that he's going to go in. And by this time, we have 40 years of humbling, 40 years of being a shepherd, 40 years of being nothing. And now Moses can go, oh, I'm so glad that he's going to be the deliverer. Okay. Then we have God saying, okay, but Moses, I'm going to use you. I'm going to be delivering, but I'm going to use you. And I'm going to send you to Pharaoh. And what does Moses do? He questions God. But God already set it up for him to be able to question him, to say, well, how does that work? Like, who am I? I don't get it. Who am I? And who are you? I have questions here. What Moses is doing is saying, this is scary. Man, how does this all work out? God already gave him the opening to be able to do that.
Even with that, I mean, it just seems like he was, knowing all that, knowing that they didn't talk, God at the time didn't talk to people individually, even when he did talk to them individually, I'm amazed then that he questioned him.
Yeah. It is pretty amazing. I do think that was part of this transformation of Moses in the wilderness, the 40 years of humility, seeing the bush and seeing that this God was willing to talk with him. Wow, this is different. Because he didn't talk at him. I mean, he wasn't standing there giving him a lecture. He was conversing with him. So we have this huge transformation in Moses, being able to question him.
Wakes you up and says, hey, I need you to pray for someone over, and it doesn't make sense to you. It doesn't even make sense. And Moses is thinking, you have been out here for 40 years.
Yeah, right.
You're gonna have to go do this,
right.
And how many people?
Right, right. There's all sorts of questions, and I'm going to ask him. And I bet that there's been times in each of our lives where we've actually had somebody in authority where we would never have questioned, but it comes to a point where, wow, now I'm so confused. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have the boldness to say, I don't get it. What are you asking me to do? So this is where Moses is. I'm asking, I don't get it. And the even more unexpected point is, God answers his fears. So he doesn't answer his question, he answers his fears. Oh, don't, Moses, this is who I am. I am able to deliver, no problem. That's my name, I am. I'm the self-existent one, the one who is always here, working covenant. This is who I am. This is how he answers Moses, which is a huge answer because it just answered not just the specific questions, but all the fearful questions. Oh, you're working out covenant and you're self-existent. You don't need me, but you're using me and you're giving me your power, all of this. Now, does Moses consciously understand all this? Obviously not, because he still has questions later in the next chapter. But Abraham, same story. Exactly right. Exactly. So we have...
probably be the same story, too.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly. So he gives him, look, I am. I am working right now. I am in the present right now. I have enough power and enough sufficiency that in who I am, I will be with you in doing this. I am able to do all of this. So what's he doing? He's assuring Moses of his presence, that he's going to be with him. And what is covenant about? We're one. We're one. I'm sharing my life with you. And this is what he's doing here. Moses. That comes in later.
Okay.
Yep. And he's also giving him assurance that his faithfulness to covenant is more than enough for all of life. So he's bringing him back. He's teaching him. He's equipping him to understand that believing covenant is enough. Covenant will always cover life. Always. So we have one more section, and verses 16 through 22. So we have God saying, Moses, I'm going to send you to the elders of Israel, and I'm going to have you tell them that I visited you and that I care about what's happening to them. And that, just that in itself, for him to say that to Moses, I can't imagine what Moses is thinking. Okay, I'm going back to the Israelites who don't want to have anything to do with me, and I'm going to tell them, hey, I saw God. You haven't, but I've seen God.
40 years have gone by, so
yeah, yeah.
Some of those people may not be there anymore.
Remember, Moses will be 80, so a lot of people of those people won't be there. He goes back to a generation that is, you know, getting older, but obviously Moses still has 40 more years in him, so so do some of the others. So what's the unexpected? He reveals the unexpected story. So what he doesn't do, because this is what we think, this is how God works. Oh, God says he's going to deliver, and it's just going to be, he's just going to, you're done, you're delivered. But this is what God says. So I'm going to have you go to the Israelites, and they'll believe you, but then I'm going to have you go to Pharaoh, and he's not. And it's going to take him a long time, and I'm going to have to produce some judgments and miracles before he'll let you go. And then when he lets you go, you're going to leave rich. Now, that's a story. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, all Moses probably thought, I'm going to go in there and they're going to be freed. And now Moses goes, wow, the story's a little more complicated than that. They're going to be delivered and I'm going to help, but it's not going to be an easy button.
Which speaks something to Moses' character.
Yes, it does.
And I wonder if it ever happened to us that we just
right,
you know.
Exactly, exactly. But what has God done? He has matured Moses for 40 years of humility in the wilderness to be at a point where he can say, okay, I'll do it. Now, he's still afraid, and he's still going to be conversing with God on this. He's still afraid.
He says, send somebody else.
Yes, he does say, send somebody else.
And I would say.
And here's the cool thing. God says, yeah, at this point, I'm not giving you a choice. Mm-hmm. Did we talk about, I don't know if it was all of us or as a group or just singly, we talked about God gives us choices, but he doesn't give us all choices because he's still making sure that his plan works. So that there are times we didn't have a choice of our parents. We don't have a choice about how our body looks. We don't have, you know, our physical nature. We don't have, you know, there are a lot of choices we don't have. And this is one of the choices where God's going to say, yeah, that choice you don't have. You are going to go. But I am understanding your fear. So we'll talk about that more next week.
Clear one other thing for me. I didn't know that all the elders were going with him.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm. I thought it was just him and maybe him and Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
But then he says, you're going to go and ask to go for 3 days into the journey.
Right.
He's not really saying, let us all go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He is also what he's doing here, and you'll see it. We'll go in there. He is also giving Pharaoh a chance. He's not trying to push Pharaoh into a corner. He's giving Pharaoh a chance. Will you let my people go just for 3 days? Will you let him go for 3 days? And pretty soon, and we'll talk about how Pharaoh's heart gets hardened from that. But again, see, God is never against anyone. He's always giving them opportunities. And here, this is an opportunity for Pharaoh. Because this is an easy thing. I'll just let him go 3 days and come back.
Mm-hmm. So kind of since Pharaoh didn't choose curtain A.
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay, fine, exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
You know when it says that you put on here how God understood their fears?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. yes, sin is condemned, mm-hmm. more sin is paid for on the cross. But God doesn't condemn our humanity.
Exactly.
And I find exactly. myself over and over in the counseling room reminding myself of that truth and reminding my client of that truth. Like,
yep.
You know what I mean? They were,
yes.
He didn't condemn them for being afraid.
Exactly. Exactly. And if we're honest about him, God, I'm afraid. And this is what Moses was doing. God meets us right there.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I'm going to give you something for your fear. I'm going to give you the assurances, which is what covenant is about. But let's say in a marriage covenant, if I don't come to my covenant partner with my fears, then he has no way to be with me in my fear, right? And then we have a wall.
Same with
that's the problem.
Like the human emotion of anger,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, we have to go to our marriage partner and say, in order for reconciliation, I'm feeling angry. But if I
yep.
just pretend it's not there, then,
right.
you know.
Right.
So same too.
With God.
We
sit yep.
with God, and we see that in the Psalms where David.
Right, exactly.
So many
exactly.
emotions. But I don't know, it just hit me right here about how, like, God wasn't like, well, stupid idiot, I can't believe you're afraid.
Right. Well, and exactly, again, he's showing the difference between what we think a God is like
mm-hmm.
and who he really is. I'm transformational. You can bring me anything you want, and I'll deal with it. Just don't pretend it's not there. Because that puts a wall between us. That says, you can't trust me with your fear or your anger or anything. But he's already, right at the very beginning, he did it with Abraham, he's doing it with Moses. I'm willing to listen. I am bigger than that, and I can hear your fears. I can help you with those. So yes,
with
good
Pharaoh
point.
Too. I mean, he knew Pharaoh's heart.
Yes,
he
exactly,
I mean,
exactly.
He
see, he's still this transformational God all over and over and over again. Okay, so he reveals that the elders will listen, that they'll go. Pharaoh won't listen. He'll do miracles, and they'll be delivered with abundance. What's he doing? He's assuring them of his utter faithfulness to covenant. By confirming the exact details that he gave Abraham over 400 years ago. And at this point, somebody of the remnant is saying, hey, this is a story we know. Somebody is bringing that. Not very many, though, because we'll see over and over again that they still don't get it. So, whose story? It's God's story. How he's fulfilling covenant. But he's paying attention to the individuals in the story. So, the playwright director is always in control of the story because it is his story after all. So here's the scenes, just one after another. He takes a boy sold into slavery, and he makes him a ruler who will save his family. I'm talking about Joseph there. He takes a famine that threatens to extinguish a small family, and he makes a peaceful place for them to flourish. He takes oppression, and he uses it to increase his people in number and might. He takes disobedience to a powerful king, and he blesses Gentile midwives with families. He takes an intended place of death, which is where they were supposed to throw the babies, Nile, and he turns that into a vehicle for life for Moses. He takes an edict to kill, and he turns it into an opportunity to hide so that he protects a leader that will be formed in Pharaoh's own house. He takes common arrogance, and what I mean by common is common to every one of us, the arrogance that Moses had to go ahead and do for God, which always give death, and he turns that into an opportunity to be rejected and needy. And those are great opportunities. He takes a fearful flight, and he turns it into an opportunity to learn humility and give life to others. He takes a lengthy time of hard living and turns it into a cry for real life for the Israelites. He takes a humbled priest prince. Remember, he came from the line of Levite. He was a prince. Turned to shepherd, and he turns him into a savior. In other words, he does exactly what Joseph said. Although the world meant it for evil, God meant it for good and to bring life. The storyline is that God's faithfulness to covenant in the present, right now, in your life, is more real than whatever you see right now on the surface. So, what I want you to do, before you even think about application, I want you to do application. Within our little arc here, I have little storybooks. And what I want you to do is I want you to take one of the storybooks, and they're mini, because you just have little mm-hmm. stories. And I want you to take some of the stories that you thought about that you don't like to share. And I want you to write them. And I don't mean the story. I just mean one or two words for your own self. No one else is going to see this. the stories that you have. And after you've written them, I want you to put them back into the ark. I want you to put them into the place that looks like death. These places in your life right now that look like death, that look like I can't, what possibly good could come from this? I want you to put them into the ark and be like Jochebed and let it go off out of your control and watch to see the story underneath that God is actually working covenant in those very stories, the stories you have today. Does that make sense? So they're just little tiny ones. You've got 4 pages. You can do 4 different stories of your life or whatever, just a sentence or two. We're going to lock them back up in that ark, and we will take them out at the end in February. And you can have them back. We're not going to read them. You can have them back. And you can decide whether you've begun to see God actually working covenant. You may be like the Hall of Faith in Hebrews. You may not get to see any of the workings out. But you need to be looking for how God, because God is right now doing that. Not he will do that. He is today. Whatever the situation is, whether it's, you know, rebellious family members, whether it's something in your own life, a sin, whatever, God is using that. And what he's always doing is saying, I've got opportunity for life or death. I want to use it for life. Whatever your choice is, I'm going to use it. I think the story of Moses and the story of the Israelites in Egypt is probably one of the most impactful God working out covenant underneath. So that if you look at that and you can't understand that the same thing is working for you, then you've missed the reason God put in the whole story of the Exodus. The Jewish people identify themselves as people of the Exodus, but they always forget what the story was, that it was God working a covenant. Because they always say, never again, right? They say that about the Holocaust. They say it about Exodus. We've been taken out and we should never again be kidnapped again. But they miss the fact that underneath, God was working covenant out within the slavery. Put something on that. Yeah, your name is fine. Because I'm not going to look. I'm going to lock it up and I'm going to put it away and I won't take it out again. So no one will see these, but yeah, put your name on because you won't know. I didn't purposely do the leaves and everything for this reason, but once I did, I thought, oh yeah, this is a good thing to remember that it looks like death. I mean, we look like we're going to have an early death here with our trees. Our trees are turning and they're browning and they're losing leaves. It looks like death, but it's really, do you remember how we talked about this? The leaves fall, and hopefully you let them disintegrate into the ground so that they can give life again. So in here looks like death. Your little stories that look like death, God is working covenant to bring life out of them. So whenever you're done with that, you can go ahead and put them in. I should probably take out the ones that are written. Put them in the little ark there, our little reed basket. And I will end the tape here.